Now, to continue from last class, I probably spent more time on Rabbi Berkowitz than I would have otherwise, because in some way I was trying to get the point across, not just to you, but to myself, because I entered the scene already when he was no longer the only voice. So I had to do justice, because there's a lot of people out there who took him so seriously. To continue just the timeline, we're going to do the 60s, we're going to do Rav Yitz Greenberg and Meir Kahana and Shlomo Riskin next class. But just to reiterate a sense of a timeline for us, material that we have not discussed. If we're coming in the 40s and 50s, I would recommend as a summer read Chaim Potok's book, The Chosen and the Promise, which give you an insight into that YU world of 1950, people coming from Brooklyn looking how to do master's degrees in math. Every person in those books are real. Okay, it's really about Rav Gorelick and Rav Shatzkus, and every single classmate is real. At one point we went around and named every single person in the room, because they were not, as much as they're fiction, they're not fiction. Okay? Hold on. When the beginning of the 1950s, post-war, veterans heading out into suburbia were very practical, very this-worldly oriented. Pragmatic. By the end of the 50s and the beginning of the 60s, we have theology. We have the need to be more theological, and therefore journals like Tradition are founded. You also now have critics of suburbia. What? You have critics of suburbia in which it's worth paying attention to their criticisms, and I gave you Looking for God in the Suburbs, which will give you, fill you in on many of the creation of the suburbs and the critique. Okay. To move forward, Robert Wuffnow, professor at Princeton, in his book, After Heaven, it's on the syllabus, describes the 1950s as a period of dwelling. People knew you had to belong to organized religion. It was in one place. It was local. The 1960s, on the other hand, was a time when it was coming undone intellectually, but not yet socially. Coming into the beginning of the 1960s, you'll have conflicting noise. On one hand, you will have a greater sense of ecumenicism and the brotherhood of all religions, National Brotherhood Week, that we all say the same thing, which Martin Marty describes very well in his book. On the other hand, you will have the immorality of the 1960s typified by figures like Elizabeth Taylor committing adultery in public, which was a huge scandal for the early 1960s. You'll have Kennedy's Great Society that we're going to change things. And a sense we're entering into a secular age. By the end of the 1960s, you have the grand sense of modernity of landing on the moon and new technologies. I mean, that's when the new technologies are beginning to really show themselves. You have the era of hippies and social protest. You have anti-war protest. Come the 70s, that's the era that people really will demographically start checking out of organized religion. Many in the 70s, it was very in to really not be part of the system. It was the great age of disestablishmentarianism. You know, you think of the movies MASH or Hospital making fun of the medical system, Catch-22, books that really did not believe in the system. And so many of the best and brightest either temporarily or permanently checked out. And to go from the Chaim Potok novel describing 1950, if you want things that describe the world of 1975, I would suggest reading Rebecca Goldstein's Mind-Body Problem, which deals with the Orthodox world, modern Orthodox world of the mid-70s. And you can see people were boldly willing to be temporarily transgressors in order to embrace the era. You can look at Nefsa Rappaport's preparing for Shabbat. You can look at, even coming from Brooklyn, Yossi Klein Halevi's Memoirs of a Jewish Extremist. People knew they were heading forth into a new world. The 1970s is an era also of first wave feminism, an era of black power being taken, now being realized on the social level, and an era on the Jewish level of Jewish pride. It's the start of kippah wearing, being Jewish in public, and fighting for Jewish issues in public. Beginning of the 1970s, many a college campus, even the Hillel, would hide the menorah because they wouldn't want to stick out for being too Jewish. The Hanukkah menorah. By the end of the 70s, that is gone. But clearly the 70s, the answers of the 1950s will not completely satisfy the 70s. And then come to the 80s, we're going to have a return to religion, which we'll talk about afterwards. I give you that only as a broad scheme. We'll talk more in greater detail. But you need a little bit of background before we do Rabbis Lamb and Rabbi Wurzburger. We will talk about the 60s and 70s for their own sake next class and the class afterwards. Yes? Okay, the answer is there will be a greater, there will already be seen as, what's his name, a letter handler book, and I forgot the name of his book, where he talks about, he put out 2 years ago, on the Jewish city and its discontent. This is already, people are now fighting against housing projects in Forest Hills and Hillcrest. There is already shifts of fighting, either fighting for your neighborhoods or the flee of Jews from the 150s and the 160s up into the higher parts of Washington Heights. There are battles that are going on, but it's not a new generation. It is part of the upheavals of the 60s and 70s. And in many ways, it's going to be Jews versus Afro-Americans. Yes?
It's not the same people. Europe and then move to the suburbs.
No, it is not.
Generation people who are moving to the suburbs.
No, it's neither of the above. Meaning, nobody, this is not a great, it's not the great change of the 80s where, you know, people are moving from Queens to Teaneck or people are moving from Brookline to Newton. This is fights within. Which neighborhoods are being maintained, which are going up, which are going down. Fights within neighborhoods, regardless of where you came from. So you could be all American, third generation American, fighting not to put up a housing project in Hillcrest. Or you could be an immigrant German Jew living on 155th Street who's now fleeing up to the 190s.
Another point.
Yeah.
What role would you say that since they were playing this?
Let's come to the 60s next time.
And also,
please, like I said, please don't jump ahead to the 60s. Yes, I just.
And then just start in the early 50s, what role would you say that Shlomo Carlach was on the
track? That's all part of next time. You please, I've asked you three times in a row. Okay. Okay. The I'm going to open up with a sermon from Walter Wurzberger from September 1969. Man had landed on the moon that summer of 69, which was a great event at the time. Everyone saw that this was a new era for mankind. Religion will never be the same. Our cosmologies will never be the same. And here is the sermon coming back after the summer that Rabbi Walter Wurzberger delivers. The landing of Apollo 11 on the Sea of Tranquility has not only opened new frontiers for man, but has ushered in an entirely new era, which demands a radical overhauling of many of our antiquated ideals and values. We have witnessed what the prophet Isaiah has termed the making of a new heaven and earth. But while the heavens have receded, they have not shrunk. Our awareness of the vastness of the heavenly expanses, most of which will forever elude man's reach, deepens our awe for the mystery of creation. Unless our perspective will be destroyed by arrogance, our newly gained knowledge should increase rather than diminish our faith in the Creator. Skipping ahead. It is becoming increasingly evident that unless we achieve some kind of spiritual breakthrough, man, either literally or figuratively speaking, will suffocate in the atmosphere he has polluted through his short-sightedness. All over the world, there's a growing apprehension over our failure to develop the moral and spiritual resources that enable us to come to grips with the agonizing problems of our time. Does it really make sense to land on the moon with the most up-to-date equipment, but with values and ideas which are totally obsolete today, since they are hardly adequate even for the horizons of primitive man? It is perhaps no coincidence that man has reached the moon precisely at the time that Israel has once again emerged as a sovereign, independent nation in its ancient homeland. It is against this background that Jews should consider their meaning, a generation that has been an eyewitness both to the Holocaust and the rebirth of the State of Israel, is perhaps too close to the scene to appreciate the full dimension of these events. Yet somehow we can sense what the prophet Isaiah wanted to convey when he promised a new heaven and a new earth. And then the sermon continues about the need for a new heaven, a new earth, and a new perspective. You know, that's pretty strong stuff. Pretty strong sense of having modernity breathing down your neck. And the two figures we're going to deal with today are going to be the two intellectuals that answer those questions for modern orthodoxy. One, Rabbi Lamb, who for many, his was the skeptics, the guide for how do you approach this. And his approach is going to be very much geared to contemporary events, the newspaper, what's making the front of Life magazine. While Rabbi Wurzberger is going to be our first figure that's going to be having read Buber, Rosenzweig, Hermann Cohen, all the new Germans, and part of that new theological thinking that's coming to America. And he's going to be our first real non-pragmatist, but instead American-German philosopher dealing with deeper issues. And so with that, I will get started first on Rabbi Lamb's faith and doubt. Now, Rabbi Lamb's faith and doubt does come still with that Rabbi Belkin sense that everything is a telos, everything is synthesis. The subtitle that the book came out with was still called Studies in Traditional Jewish Thought. But his introduction already, he begins to talk about we are modern Orthodox, which he sees as an unhappy semantic hybrid. I mean, he knows there's two polar opposites, and a Orthodox part and a modern part, and how do you resolve it? Let's go through the issues. Essay 1, which is the title of the book, Faith and Doubt, talks about there's a problem of belief in our age of confusion. People now doubt God, doubt religion. And that's why I brought up the 60s and 70s. Not because we're there yet, but because he's already addressing it, that we're in a period of doubt. Not that people are intellectual doubters, but it's an age of confusion. He's saying he's not writing his book for those people who are outside the system, but he's writing for those who are Orthodox, that do have doubts. He does quote a figure like Harvey Cox, who wrote a book called The Secular City in the 60s about how America is going to be all secular. And he says Orthodox, modern Orthodox Jews have to be integrated into the world. He'll quote Eliezer Berkowitz prominently, that Jews are not to be the Naturae Carta of the nations. That quote will come up in Rabbi Wurzberger and others. That'll be a well-remembered quote. We have a message. Now, dealing with faith and doubt, he will admit that there are some people out there who have emunah tamima, simple faith. He's not addressing them. He, on the other hand, is addressing those who need a stronger faith. And he will talk about faith as using Bachya, Sadia, and Rambam in a very general sort of way. I'm going to get to it. You can see he's read Harry Wolfson, the professor from Harvard's books on Jewish thought, where he talks about the double faith theory, in which we seek faith after we have understanding. Meaning, yes, we go to college, and most college professors delight in teaching you how to reject your faith or making fun of religion, he says in the 60s, which was true. But know that when he's writing this essay, know that most college graduates were conservative. They were not Orthodox. I mean, Orthodox did not have a strong percentage of college graduates until centrism. Hold on. He will mention the college, that you still go to college and expose yourself to these professors. He does not, and it's important to note, he does not go to the centrist route of saying you understand secular knowledge through faith or Yirat Shemayim. He doesn't go the centrist route warning about the dangers of college and to avoid it. No, he says you go anyway, but you've still now got to go back to learn how to maintain your faith. He mentions how Buber distinguishes between cognitive knowledge and personal knowledge, and introduces a third category of knowledge called functional faith. Meaning the third category is Rabbi Lamb's, not Buber's. So where Buber it's between knowledge and relationship, Rabbi Lamb introduces a third category of functional, pragmatic, still keeping the mitzvot even if you have doubts. Okay, don't let your doubts affect keeping mitzvot. And he's going to cite John Dewey and James. Like, until Rabbi Wurzberger, we hear lots of pragmatic resonances within modern Orthodoxy. He then has a reading of Sadia's book, Emunot V'Deot, in which the actual title, Emunot V'Deot, which is mistranslated as beliefs and opinions, really means there are emunot, there are certain knowledge that I proceed cognitively and that I can then logically extend, and then there are deot, there's human opinions. In Rabbi Lamb's reading, this becomes an opening for saying certain things I have proof for, and certain things I know there's a realm of opinion, and the 1960s are universities. The realm of opinion is going to be anti-religion. But he says openly, it is okay for methodological doubt. It is okay to go take courses in comparative religion, even if your professor is going to take joy in refuting religion, because methodological doubt is acceptable. It's part of life. It means the doubt that comes from an academic study or a doubt that comes temporarily, either just through a period of your life or through during your college era. It's a certain thing, or exposing yourself to a certain opposite position temporarily. He says it's okay. Very unlike the centrist positions we're going to see. And then he'll talk about substantive doubt, which is different. Substantive doubt is when the doubt becomes ingrained in you, and that he is going to say no. You've got to always remain pragmatically attached. So intellectually, he'll create a methodological realm of doubt. Substantively, you always remain pragmatically keeping mitzvot. He will talk about how the inner life of man should be experiencing of God, and that we should strive for deeper faith. He says honest doubt is never hostile to Torah. And he'll quote on that figures like Rav Kook and Heschel about honest doubt not being against Torah. But keeps coming back to the need for a pragmatic keeping of mitzvot despite your doubts. And he'll quote William James, Bishop Butler's critique of Barclay that we saw in Shadal, and Reb Chaim of Elazhin, who believed that all that counted was halacha. And even if you're struggling, there's a value for Jobian struggles. Okay, the image of Job will take on a huge life in the 60s and 70s of struggling. Jews will be attracted to that image. There'll be several books out there with all sorts of titles, arguing with God, struggling with God, from all different sorts of rabbis. But we should never give up the fact that Bachya, Rambam, Sadia always taught us we need to have a rational religion, and at the same time we need an experiential trust in the divine. And what will help us come to God despite our doubts is prayer, Torah, and community. And on page 31 he has a quote. We've got to spend more time dealing with the college campus and intellectual issues than synagogues and sermons, because that's really the issues of the age. And now I'll take your questions on this piece. Yes?
You said that Iran said continue to approach even if you have doubts.
Yes.
Is that along the line of Shloshma Bolashma?
Oh, that was one of the Indrashot of this era.
And because if you don't say that,
Mitok Shalolishma Balishma, and also the Midrash of Halavai, they kept my Torah, even if they forget about me. Those Midrashim used to be very prevalent. Okay? Yes?
When we're talking about substantive doubt, we're not really talking about doubt. What I'm saying, if you doubt something, you do it. But don't have substantive doubt between stopping to do it.
No, he's going to distinguish between calling that one the Buberian intellectual doubt, where versus stopping to do something is only functional. He's going to create three categories, which are cognitive, emotional, and functional. And he's going to make it saying even if you remain with intellectual doubts, you remain don't on a functional level have doubts. The second one he doesn't do, he says that tefillah, Torah, and community will develop the second one, but he doesn't develop that in that essay. It's an underplayed part, yes.
So, I guess, sort of, you answered my question, but basically going to be regarding whether his position is pragmatic, that, you know, you should get out in order that you should come back to the fold, or that it's okay with doubt in general, and then it's a quite fine, happy, go lucky, that's a pretty good state of existence. In other words, does he think doubt is inevitable?
He is not phrasing, he's phrasing the question, you know, with a clear image like many of us have of Professor Gaster having a lot of fun taking the Frum students at Columbia and Barnard and making fun of them and making fun of their ancient religion as part of the course. I mean, there's a clear number of professors we had in mind. You know, I'm sure he had some of them in mind, and that people would come out of those courses already questioning the truth of religion.
This seems almost stopgap, though. Where did he see these people who had doubts ending up? Would they end up making a decision, finding themselves, or...
The 60s and 70s were not about ending up. It was a period of... That's why I opened up once again. It was a period of motion, dynamism, and people really did not have a light at the end of the tunnel type of...
So there's a stopgap kind of
You're already coming in anachronistically. You have to ask, is, I don't know, did you see the movie The Hospital or Catch-22 or is that army stopgap? There was something intrinsically doubting and anti-establishment of the era that you just people saw through and you had to respond to. Don't look for, there's no light at the end of the tunnel in these writings. Personally, you can ask a question about where he went in the 80s and 90s with centrism, and that's a different question. But now you're responding to what's going on then and there.
It seems almost like it's a nechama.
It's not a nechama. It's being responding to the issues. Because now that we've landed on the moon, how can we have the same categories? Yes?
What role does Hasidus play in
the We're getting to there. Here.
Where is he?
He's Rabbi of the Jewish Center. Rabbi of the Jewish Center, editor of tradition.
Is he assuming he's talking to everybody, or just the people that he's associated with?
I think he was talking, this was talking to probably almost any thinking, doubting individual.
It's
not transcending. That's why I said, unlike the Rabbi Berkowitz, who could appear to us in NCSY, giving us a God is true because it's in the Bible, this is already now for the doubter. Whether it's convincing or not is not my question. The question is, but this was for the doubter. This is already for the thinking person. Next, yes. I don't know what's today or what age group. It clearly is translating into... It's translating into a group of older baby boomers who went through periods of doubt and non-belief and non-observance. And it's translating into a certain older... lost generation of the 50, you know, some of the older crowd still left that still maintain their skepticism from the 1930s, there were still parts of congregations. So it doesn't translate into, but it creates a room for.
Are you saying that people as not as ill or metaphoracy
that
people left
their room in this era? What era now?
Today.
I don't know anything about today. Right now we're in 1970. At best. Okay? Today is different. At this point, I will tell you, as I open, go read The Mind-Body Problem, go read Rebecca Goldstein, go read Nessa Rappaport. Go understand where that era of baby boomer was. Okay? And if you're thinking about any of those individuals still today who would now be approximately 52 years old or 56 years old, if that fits into whatever you're thinking, then that's a question of how dynamics play themselves out down the road. Okay? Next essay of the book, equally important, is Monism for Moderns. talking about we live in a drug culture, a mystical age, an age where people are turning east. And the Zohar gives us an imagery of overcoming our separations, retaining unity. And that's why we sing L'chad Dodi every Shabbat about returning to our unity. Shabbat is preserving our unity of personality and spirit, and that's what Kabbalah and Hasidus teaches us, and that's why people are turning east into drugs, is because they want to preserve their unity of personality and spirit. And that's the message of Hasidism. Of course, there's no real antinomianism in Hasidism. Modern man is desperate. We live in an age of biblical criticism, logical positivism, the atom bomb. We've neurotically splintered the self. Zohar, Hasidut, Rav Kook brings us back to a state of unity. We've got to go from the neuroses of Freud to having a holistic psychology. And Shabbat, as the Kabbalists teach us, is that moment. And then he ends with quotes from Rav Kook on the need for a unified vision. Does that answer your question? Okay, that's what it becomes. I mean, would that satisfy somebody who, you know, just spent a month in LSD and then 2 months in India and then off studying Kabbalah? The answer is no. The meaning the over. Yeah, there is that element. But the strongest influence on this book is going to be the liberal readings of Rav Kook. Not Rav Kook himself, but Rav Kook, seeker of unity, as presented by Rottenstreich, Agus, Boxer, by all the liberal rabbis' readings of Rav Kook as seeking a higher unity, is going to be his reading of Chassidut and Kabbalah. Yes?
This theme of unity, and that's what we're going to go back to India again, does he keep that theme through when it comes to the centers? I've heard him speak of basically the same idea.
He will keep some of this idea forward. But when it actually came to it, he was not a fan of any of the Jewish versions of these things that came to be in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. Yes? Yes. Yes. Kabbalah. You go general term, you read a passage of Zohar and the unifying Sefirot, you study Kabbalah Shabbat, Chassidut, Rav Kook. It's one. Because he's halachic. Because he's halachic. Isn't? That's right. That the critics are wrong. It's a vision of unity. And then he quotes basically Rav Kook to prove that. I mean, there's a blurring of the lines between Rav Kook and Chassidut.
Is he really just pointing out that if you want to be eclectic, there's eclecticism here too?
No. No. He. This is his emotional import for unity. Yes.
Where or from whom did he develop this romance with the esoteric?
I mean,
is this his own personal?
That's an interesting question. How did he come to this in the first place?
Chemistry.
No. I don't know where it came from. I don't know. I don't know where he came to this. Someone could ask him where he came to this. Chapter 3, please control yourselves. Chapter 3 is called Two Versions of Synthesis, dealing with the Belkin, remember President Belkin concept of synthesis, and he's going to contrast Hirsch to Rav Kook. So he talks about how modern orthodoxy is something new, a coming to be together of halacha and Western thought. It's needed for our age. And synthesis is not creating a new theory, but it's bringing both together in the same person. And Rav Hirsch was the creator of an enlightened orthodoxy. And he says on page 71, Hirsch doesn't say it, but in my reading of where Hirsch would go, secular should help our study of Torah, and Torah should help our study of nature and history. So his reading of Hirsch is really not coming from Hirsch himself or from, you know, any of the Hirschians. It's his own reading of if identifying Yeshiva University's modern orthodoxy in which there's a synthesis as presented by Rabbis Belkin, Roth, Rachman, now retrograding it and saying that was Hirsch's view. He points out that, however, there's something very utopian about this. To let each one affect the other one. In contrast, Rav Kook kept his Torah and Derech Eretz separate, which is the easier, more correct, more general approach to people, to have a bifurcation and to keep them separate. But to realize that yes, you have Kodesh, but also the Chol can be made Kodesh. And an image here of Rav Kook thinking about secular in religious terms, we have to sanctify the secular, and we have to think dynamically about how do we appropriate the issues of our age. So he gives an example for each, which both the original authors would reject both of them. He says Hirsch would want you to study chemistry in order to understand Yeridea better, to understand Tarovis better. Science will help you understand Hilchos Nida better, which was certainly not the rather Bildungs approach of Rav Hirsch. And he says Rav Kook wants the chemist to use halachic categories by which to understand the world of chemistry, which is also not Rav Kook. They are the two sides of Rabbi Lam. Is it a very functional knowledge that I can now bring in secular knowledge in the study of halacha? Or can I bring in my halacha and Torah into the secular classroom? And he talks about, on one hand, we're Hirschian, but that's somewhat keeping things separate. I mean, he reverses himself from the beginning of the essay. That keeps things separate. But Rav Kook brings holiness to the secular, and he's going to change his terminology and take that much further in his Centrist book, Torah Mada, later. He will say there's a danger in a synthesis. People will be lost. People will get doubts. People will lose their faith. But just the way Rav Kook wasn't worried about these things, so too we shouldn't be worried about these things. Okay. Well, the point is Rav Kook didn't advocate this, and Rav Kook was very worried about this, and from his letters, he's forever saying this is Kfira, that's Kfira, don't do the Chachmas Hagoyim. The answer, this is not a historic Rav Kook. This is Rav Kook as presented by Rabbis Agus, Buxer, and Professor Ruttenstreich. A very liberal and Bialik. It's a liberal reading of Rav Kook that's nothing at all to do with any Rav Kook or Rav Kook's real writings, and it's a Rav Hirsch that was never ever Rav Hirsch either. But you're seeing two poles of the way he's now rereading YU. He is our first rereader of YU, as placing YU as the continuity of Rav Hirsch and Rav Kook. We haven't seen that till now, and that's the essential point of this course, because Shaddal, the real Hirsch, Rav David Tzvi Hoffman, the religious Zionists, Rav Reines, Rav Horgan, all disappeared before this essay. This essay basically says modernity happened, Rav Kook and Hirsch responded, YU is the direct outgrowth of Rav Hirsch and Rav Kook. Everything we've been doing till now in this course has now disappeared from the YU agenda. Okay. Why what? Can you phrase that as a what?
Why throw away like the entire American method at that point?
No one's throwing away. It's now formulating it as two great thinkers.
Why did we decide to refresh on the cookers?
Okay, so the answer is because Rav Hirsch, as I told you when we did Rav Hirsch, in the Jewish histories of Gretz, Grezel, Margolis, and Marx, Hirsch becomes the father of neo-Orthodoxy, modern Orthodoxy, and Rav Kook is seen as now modernizing for the land of Israel. This is not a historic consciousness, but a philosophic consciousness in which they are taken as the two paradigms. So this essay has incredible ramifications in why for the last 30 years nobody we've mentioned till now in the course has been talked about. Yes? Okay. Next, yes?
So on the institutional level, what's going on as Ralph Cook and the Persia are going to be reread this way? Is this like religious Zionism meets American pragmatism?
Meaning, why are they being...
Meaning, where to reread something, you have to have some kind of prior agenda.
Right.
What is that agenda?
The agenda is synthesis. But where synthesis in part of our versions till now either had religious Zionists' great visions of the meaning of history, or had Rabbi Roth's vision of methodological... real, we're doing something new here. This is now saying synthesis is modern orthodoxy. Modern orthodoxy has now been made as an event of the last 200 years. Yes?
What part of why you just get to see the synthesis is supposed to be taking place? Is he really putting it in the case? Is he putting it in with the rabbi?
At this point, he's not head of YU yet. He is putting it in the person.
It's just each person who's in YU.
That's right.
This is what they are doing.
He's not YU. This is
the
thinking person.
Just doing
the thinking person. Yes. Yeah. No, there was a clear goal here to be the philosopher and cite the philosophers of Rav Hirsch and Rav Kook because you want to attribute yourself to great philosophers. He would have been one of those top, you know, name the top 25 thinkers of modern Jewry. You would have put there, you know, Geiger, Hirsch, Chara'am. He would have been in that pantheon. Yes.
It did.
It didn't mean meaning. No, it didn't. No, it was just not only. It was just not a tale. There's nothing historic here. This is about a great philosophic figure. It's switching it over to great philosophers. Yes.
Is this book or any other similar modern
thinkers
putting up any
city
thinkers besides
your book? Does he? he will quote a bon mot at many points. We're going to get to that, but they almost always will be tied in to a Rav Kook or a modern with it. I mean, it's not having its own thrust. Okay, in some place I have at home on file his course on Chassidut that he used to give in EMC. You know, it's a very general sort of course. Okay. His next essay on, which I'm going to deal with, is this one on extraterrestrial life. Now that we've landed on the moon, can we deal with extraterrestrial life? And he talks about all the newspapers accepting an evolution from inorganic to organic life. But what really counts is, no matter what scientific theory we hold, and he's going to put a lot of them out there, a lot of acceptance of evolution and of extraterrestrial life and all sorts of wild science fiction things that were being said in the late 60s. Do we have any Isaac Asimov or Ray Bradbury type readers here? Meaning, it's coming from that world, but he says what you have to remember is the uniqueness of human life. And that man's relationship to God is unique. He mentions how we now know that dolphins have an ethical sense. So maybe you'll question that there could be life on other planets that have ethical senses just like humans. But the answer is, as Viktor Frankl tells us, we're the only being that searches for meaning. And therefore, even if there are beings on other planets that are ethical, that doesn't mean they search for meaning the way we search for meaning. He's responding to the issues of the day. Next chapter I want to deal with is ecology. He talks about we have a new awareness from Rachel Carson's Silent Spring about pollution, about the environment. Meaning Earth Day wasn't until 1970, but we have to care about the environment. And he answers, Judaism has always cared about these things. Shabbat is our succession from work. We understand there's a Sidrei Bereshit. We worry about Baal Tashrit. Hasidic sources talk about finding God in the natural order. But we shouldn't forget the Misnaged sources that talk about man, the creator, the scientist. Meaning he reads Nefesh HaChayim as if it's the Rav's halachic man. But the Hasidic sources are giving us our ecological dimension. And Judaism is two poles, man the creator and man the ecologist. And we just have to remember not to become a pagan nature worshiper out of this. What about the problem of leisure? Now people are worried, another essay, the problem of leisure. People are worried that leisure will create an existential vacuum. Answer, Heschel's The Sabbath shows us the holiness of time, shows us that even when we have leisure, we can have creativity, we can have a sense of experiencing God, we have a purpose to what we do. And then he says, and also we learn not just from Hasidim, like Heschel, we also learn from Misnagdim about the need for study, and our leisure time should be used for study. He comes back to Chassidut Mitnagdut as his polar answer for most things. His essay number 8, it's called Scholarship and Piety, he puts that directly onto the table. scholarship and piety becomes the relationship of mitnagdut to chassidut within his world. And this is already an opening from his book, Torah Lishma, which was about to come out on Chaim of Volozhin. And he paints a picture of Chaim of Volozhin as entirely evolved with study. Torah Lishma means for its intellectual cognitive value. There's nothing devotional or spiritual, it's entirely cognitive. So what he's done here is he's carved a place for studying Torah because you enjoy the intellectual activity of it, even though you don't have the yira of your youth anymore. He says mitnagdut is anti-dveikut, anti-cleaving to God, anti-homo-religious, anti-pietistic states of mind, anti-yira. It's only needed for an otzer. You only need a little bit of yira in order to keep you in the fold. And of course it's against reading of Sifrei Yira, of Musar Svarim. He points out how the Vilna Gaon rejected receiving angelic visitors, Magidim, because he was against all spirituality and supernaturalism. Mitnagdut is a disassociation principle, he calls it, in which the realm of the cognitive, the intellectual, is to be entirely kept separate from all forms of spirituality, devotion, and yira. That was Rabbi Lamb's presentation of Mitnagdut. Know that Professor Etkes of Hebrew U, I think that's an 80-page book review, really demolishing all substance to that argument, showing the incredible importance of Yira, Tarat HaMachshava, how the Vilna Gaon leads into the Musar movement, completely against that. And certainly Professor Etkes' book on Rav Yisrael Salanter openly rejects taking this approach seriously at all. But this becomes Rabbi Lamb's view that Mitnagdut and Rav Soloveitchik's halachic man are one and the same. That there is no homo-religious within the halachic man, within the Vilna Gaon and the Nefesh HaChayim. Hence the Gaon was against Musar. And you can't, all the Musarniks who claim that they learned it from the Gaon are incorrect because of our disassociation principle. Because of course Musar takes you away from cognitive study, and the Gaon wouldn't want to do that because he subscribes to our principle. Very different than comparing him to Rav Yechiel Weinberg's emphasis on Musar as values and the importance of values. And what counts is a role of knowledge for Mitnagdim. And if you want piety, then yes, there is chassidut. Our personalities need to be integrated. We need to experience Shabbat, as Heschel tells us. We need to restore unity, as Rav Kook tells us. And he also, in this essay, there's a running theme. There's student protests on campuses. There's student unrest on campuses. And he can well understand why it's on other campuses, because the American education system does not provide any sort of spiritual awareness or any justification for itself, unlike the Jewish one. Okay. Is it better be a question of detail? Not okay. Next is, what about the moral revolution? What about the late 60s? Free love. He opens up talking about Hugh Hefner and Playboy, and that he's going to call a Gnostic, anti-sexual, anti-feminist position. He's going to take that from many of the religious leaders of the time who will condemn the Playboy ethos. But he says that's... What? Still faith and doubt, but this is called Chapter 9, The Moral Revolution. But what he's worried about is now Joseph Fletcher, a theologian who had an idea of situational ethics, that there are no rules, but we've got to decide every ethic based on love. And in Joseph Fletcher's philosophy, there are no hard and fast rules anymore. It's now whatever, so long as you don't hurt anybody. You want to do what's right. And in this, he's going to say, that this is incorrect. There's no holiness in this. There's no meaningfulness. You can't tell me an 18-year-old with his passions is some new ethic. Free love doesn't make any sense. He's against all forms of living together. He's against homosexuality. Against all these antinomian forms as a form of sabbationism. Yes. And we've got to get back to a true Jewish ethic.
What?
However, I should point out that separately, he wrote an article on homosexuality for the Encyclopedia Judaica, in which he classified it as an illness, because that was cutting edge in 1969-70, because the DSM one or two at the time, the psychiatric standards of America still classified it as a sickness. So he wanted to be modern by saying it's onus and therefore it's a sickness. But what's important was where that was cutting edge and seen as liberal in 69, to continue with those positions in 2005 is where the problems become and where centrism runs into problems. The problem was not saying that in 69. So let's get that clear. Chapter 10 will deal with self-incrimination, and because at those years there was the fight about, which later became the need to have the Miranda Clause, that you cannot self-incriminate yourself, that everything you say can and will be used against you, and therefore you can't, if you didn't know that, you can't do that. And then when the Warren Court voted that in to be, he writes an article showing that Judaism has always believed against self-incrimination, and he cites the Rambam, that the Rambam says you can't have self-incrimination. Interesting in terms of method, there will be all the tshuvot that allow it, that I think Rav Bleich collected in some later year, will not be cited. It's enough to cite a single Rambam. All the questions about our relationship to whether what we should be legislating and whether we should be getting involved in Supreme Court decisions is held in abeyance. Yes? No, he does not. Okay? It's conspicuous in its absence for all of modern Orthodoxy, because Rabbis Leo Jung and all the traditionalists did talk about civil rights, and our modern Orthodox rabbis did not. Meaning, and this is important, where our traditional rabbis of the 20s, 30s, and 40s, even if they in their lives in the 50s and 60s, spoke about universal justice, modern Orthodox rabbis dealing with Jews who moved from the Lower East Side off into the suburbs did not have that universal ethic. And certainly by this point, there was already tensions between the Afro-American and the Jewish communities. Yes? Your answer is you're correct. The answer is that's why I did Rabbi Roth first, because he really stands out. There are many things about Rabbi Roth that really do stand out different because he's much more methodologically thought out. Not just once, twice, but you can really see him thinking things through. Okay. Now to Rabbi Walter Wurzberger, who, as I said, he is the one who is most is well-read, not just Buber, Rosenzweig, Niebuhr, Tillich, Brunner. He read everything academic coming out till the end of his life. He answered fully, and he dealt with academic objections in his articles or footnotes, meaning it's not just things held together homiletically, but he really dealt with critiques. He was also a presence in his incredible ethical sense, that when he taught ethics, there was this every year, it was, he merely put the responsibility on you for creating an ethical modern orthodoxy. That's why any of us who had him, he left an incredible impression. He is also going to be the first serious student of the Rav's philosophy. Everyone till now, for example, where Rabbi Lamb was much closer to Rabbi Belkin and much more of Cook and others, he's the first one who's really coming from the Rav, not just as a quote, but as working things through on a continuous basis, what should be the halachic approach to things. Okay. The essay that I want to deal with first is called Meta-Halachic Propositions from 1962. Now, Walter Wurzberger had a quality that he would coin words and then everyone would pick them up. Most of his articles, like this Meta-Halachic article, is all of 9 pages. Meaning he would write very short articles, but then everybody adopted them because they were so on the mark, and they created a language for everybody. So in his article, Meta-Halachic Principles, he says, of course we're against anti-halachic positions. But Torah is not just law. Torah includes meta-halacha. What is meta-halacha? It means ethics, philosophy, metaphysics, Kabbalah, everything we use for axiology, ontology, and application is part of halacha. Meaning halachic figures, the fact that there's a wide variety of Jewish opinions, where Maimonides is a philosopher, Nachmanides is a Kabbalist, Rav Hirsch is quoting German Romanticism, Rabbi Wurzberger will define those as the meta-halachic qualities that the Isha Halacha has in addition to their Halacha. And so he will reject considering Halacha and Agadah are not two poles like Bialik or Heschel or Rav Kook. They are not even... Agadah is not an independent source of values that can freely generate things the way it can for Rav Kook or for Heschel, but there's a meta-halachic personality in which you have both halacha and machshava coming together as one. And that will generate the axiology of the person, it will generate the cosmology and ontology, and it will be their whole worldview. Do not think it's subjective, because the halacha and this meta halacha work together. When we say Torah lo b'shamayim hi, we mean the Torah is given to human personalities who do have human subjectivity. No one's going to not deny that. Halachic men are not robots. But there's a whole worldview of Weltanschauung that includes halacha and a meta halacha. It includes objective parts and it includes subjective parts, and it even includes, unfortunately, idiosyncrasies. But they're all part of a given whole Torah personality. So Rambam is not Aristotle. Rambam is philosophy, Torah, and his own personality. It affects the halacha. There's a coming to be of meta halacha and halacha, objective and subjective, agadata and halacha. And we believe in elu ve'elu. There are many different approaches out there. Once you're a bona fide member of the halachic process, then all of these are valid. So he's going to say there's a critique out there by the conservative movement that says Reb Chaim of Volozhin was a Kabbalist, or Reb Soloveitchik was a modern philosopher, and the Rambam was an Aristotelian, so it shows you there's no core to Judaism. And the answer is no. The Rambam, the Reb Chaim, and the Rav all have a halachic core, even though they formulate their halacha using different meta-halachic categories. He believes that there's nothing. The role of empiricism is useful in creating the meta halachic answer, but it's not the whole answer. And meta halacha should be judged by its ability to formulate halacha for a given age. He says all meta halachic individuals, all halachic personalities, are selective in how they use the secular philosophies. They're not slavishly driven by it. Reb Chaim of Volozhin is not just quoting Reb Chaim Vital straight. He is adapting it for the halachic worldview. The Rav is selective in what he picks from modern philosophy, and it all has to work together. And this word meta halacha and this worldview gets picked up by many, because it now says that the halachic figure can be engaged in other activities, and it all molds it into a whole. The one who really picked this up is Professor Twersky from Harvard, who then took this meta halachic principle and would teach his graduate students. We'll talk more about the graduate students when we get to centrism. Teaches grad students to ask to study halachic figures, not to study the Hamon Am. But when you do a halachic figure, to ask the attitude of the halachic figure toward philosophy, Kabbalah, Agadata, poetry, Parshanut. What? The world of how these meta halachic principles fit in. In some ways, this is going to be a return to the German idea of a Weltanschauung, that people have a world view, and that there is that things are value driven. But here, the values will not be seen as separate from the law, or values driving the law. The law and the values work as one, as meta halachic principles. Okay, in 9 pages, he has created a terminology that most of the intelligent rabbis, most of Orthodox academia, has used until this day. And all of his essays will be equally seminal. Is that he gets an idea, he will write it up, he'll put the critiques, and it becomes, now people will pick it up and will not even necessarily attribute it to him anymore, because he worked it out. Give me 2 more minutes. Where does this come back to Reb Soloveitchik? Is this now uses the Reb Soloveitchik language of halachic man? First thinker we've seen that's a Reb Soloveitchik thinker. But at the same time, we'll talk about it in terms of halachic men. That the Rav is not the be-all and end-all. The Rambam was one model, the Ramban another, Rav Chaim of Elazhen another. And that each figure always used meta-halacha besides their halacha. And this is a reading of what the Rav is doing in his writings. That the Rav is not just doing halacha the way a centrist might think. That the Rav was advocating meta halacha in his very writing of Machshava essays. And these 9 pages are now going to be a formulation of a modern orthodoxy saying you've got to deal with meta halacha cases, not just halacha. And we'll continue with Rabbi Wurzberger and then into the 60s next time. Well, yes. Not then.
What are how much do these people have to do with Jacobs? To what extent do these people interact with Jacobs? Somewhat a similar point.
Yeah.
But is he blacklisted?
The answer is we can talk about that when we talk about Yitz Greenberg and Company next. Because Louis Jacobs fits into the Yitz Greenberg. There's definitely going to be a cut through.
Is this a summary, like a